You are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
My name's Richard Moore and you're listening to the Cycling Podcast in what is a very sad week for the sport with the tragic death of Bjorg Lambrecht at the Tour of Poland on Monday. Lionel Burney is taking a holiday this week. I'm here in London with Daniel Freib. And Daniel, we do sadly have tragedies in cycling. We've had to cover the deaths of riders in races before on the podcast, and it's obviously always extremely sad and extremely difficult. This one has, I think, hit people particularly hard because Lambrecht was only 22. He was this very fresh-faced kid, really, in only his second season as a professional with Lotto Soudal, World Tour team, of course. An awful tragedy. And I think a few things have shocked people about it. His age, of course, his promise, his talent. I'm not sure how much these should be factors in how much we mourn someone's death, but he was a great talent. Fourth in Flèche Wallonne this year, best young rider in the Dauphiné a bit later on, second to Egan Bernal in the Tour de l'Avenir a couple of years ago, and Bernal, of course, being the recent Tour de France winner. So Bjorg Lambrecht was someone who was very much on our radar, wasn't he? And we were watching his progress with great interest.
Yeah, he definitely was, Rich, and he had been since he'd had a sparkling amateur career. He actually turned professional last year, and it wasn't supposed to turn professional, but he'd looked at, well, there were a number of his peers, guys who he'd competed against a lot as an amateur, the likes of Bernal, Sivakov, who had turned professional, and that sort of changed his mind. So he decided at the start of last year, 2018, that he would turn professional. It was a curious incident when he went to his first race, what was going to be his first race, a World Tour race, Tour Down Under in 2018, and he hadn't been signed up to the UCI testing pool for long enough to be eligible, but he went there anyway, rode the whole race. So that was one thing that immediately brought him to people's attention. But you know, since then he'd really distinguished himself with results, hadn't he? And he was nicknamed or known as Matchbox, a very diminutive rider, small in stature, but was an excellent climber. The Tour de France, as we know, started in Brussels this year, and it's been, how long is it? 1976 was the last Belgian Tour de France winner. I did a little feature for ITV talking to people about, you know, the likelihood of a Belgian Tour winner in the near future, and the obvious name that came up was Remco Evenepoel, but another name was Bjorg Lambrecht.
Yeah, very sad indeed. It happened on stage 3 of the Tour Poland. Stage 4 was neutralised. We've seen this before as well. It's cycling's way of paying tribute, I suppose, if somebody dies midway through a stage race. I remember in particular Fabio Casartelli. When he died during the Tour de France in 95, the tribute paid by his Motorola teammates. And this was similar, where, you know, the teams rode along in a procession. Lotto Soudal led them out and came into the finish, stopped before the line for a minute's silence. I mean, really, really hard to watch. The bunch just sort of moving along in silence and at pretty slow pace. And then this tribute at the end, just before the line. I mean, you really, you know, shoulders rocking in the bunch and riders rubbing their eyes and crying, as you'd expect. I think a lot of Soudal team have been offered the opportunity to carry on in the race, and it seems that some of them will. We're speaking the day after that tribute, but unbearably sad, and it is the news that obviously has dominated this week, in a week where we thought we were going to be talking mainly about another young Belgian, Remco Evenepoel, and his incredible win at the San Sebastian Classic. We will talk about that a bit later, and we'll hear from Jan-Peter de Vlieger, the journalist at Het Nieuwsblad, on both Bjorg Lambrecht and on Remco Evenepoel a little bit later on. And we'll speak a bit more about Lambrecht, but there has been, of course, other news since the Tour de France and some racing, which we'll cover now. I mentioned the San Sebastian Classic, you know, comes a week after the Tour de France. It's a great race on a pretty challenging course, and a really surprising winner this year in 19-year-old Remco Evenepoel. great things have been expected of him, but not quite so soon. And he won ahead of Greg Van Avermaet, his fellow Belgian, and Mark Hirschi, the young rider at Team Sunweb, who is also 20, I think, Hirschi, and overlooked maybe that performance, but that was pretty extraordinary. I remember he put in some very strong performances at the start of the year in the E3 Classic in particular. I spoke to him at the finish there, and you know, he performed beyond his expectations there. So third at San Sebastian, a phenomenal result for him. And Evenepoel was very impressive indeed. We'll talk a bit more about him later on. In the first edition of the women's race in San Sebastian, it was won by Lucy Kennedy of Australia and Mitchelton Scott, ahead of Yannicka Ensing and Paulina Royackers. In London, at the Ride London Classic, Elia Viviani won the bunch sprint there ahead of Sam Bennett and his teammate and lead-out man at De Koninck Quickstep, Michael Morkov. The women's race the previous evening was won by Lorena Wiebes after Kirsten Wild was disqualified for a dangerous manoeuvre which caused a big crash. Elisa Balsamo was second, Corinne Rivera was third. Tour Poland obviously has been overshadowed by tragedy this week, but Stage 1 was won by Pascal Ackermann, the German sprinter at Bora Hansgrohe, Stage 2 by Luka Mezgic of Mitchelton Scott, and Stage 3 also by Ackermann. At the Tour of Alsace, Tom Pidcock was the winner there, his first real test in big mountains. There was a stage at La Planche des Belles Filles that he won, again another rider of whom great things are expected. I'm going to mention another event that is not something we really cover in the regular cycling podcast. Our Explore series over the winter will definitely cover this, but Fiona Kolbinger won the Transcontinental race. She's a 24-year-old medical student from Germany. It was her first race, and she's the first woman to win the Transcontinental race, and that really caught a lot of people's imagination. I heard her on Radio 4 this morning. An incredible story, and like I say, we'll definitely have an interview with her in the Explore series later in the year or at the start of next year. A bit of transfer news as well. August the 1st, of course, is the date at which teams are allowed to announce signings for the following year. Matteo Trentin to CCC from Mitchelton Scott, we expected that. Mikel Landa to Bahrain Merida from Movistar, expected that too. Brandon McNulty to UAE, Team Emirates. Gabriel Cullig, the young British rider, is joining Movistar from Team Wiggins-Lacolle. Elia Viviani and Fabio Sabatini to Cofidis from De Koninck Quickstep. We also expected that for a long time. And Lawrence Nassen joining his brother Oliver Nassen at AG2R. Lots more transfer news as well. And we'll try and keep you abreast of the big transfers over the coming weeks.
The fastest clothing in the world tour. The home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Ratha in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
It's difficult. I can only speak from a male's perspective, but it's difficult for the modern male to feel confident when wearing spandex and or lycra. My name is Taylor Finney, and I ride for EF Education First Pro Cycling Team. Therefore, your comfort and your confidence is essential when you're putting on your bicycle clothing. I will admit that this is the most comfortable and the most confident that I've felt. They are the best bib shorts in the world.
Thank you very much to our headline sponsor, Rafa. Very grateful to them for their support. And a reminder that you can follow the EF Education First team through the films that RAFA have been making, and you'll find them at the RAFA channel on YouTube or at rafa.cc. A few from the Tour de France, including The Men Who Direct, which follows their sports directors Charlie Wigelius, Andreas Clear and Tom Southam, which is an interesting insight into them and the work that they do. So you'll find that at rafa.cc or at YouTube. We were talking earlier on, of course, about the awful tragedy this week. Bjørg Lambrecht sadly passed away at just 22 years of age during Stage 3 of the Tour of Poland. I spoke this week to Belgian journalist Jan-Pieter de Vlieger of Het Nieuwsblad about Lambrecht and reaction to his death in Belgium. Here's what Jan-Pieter had to say. Yeah, I mean, JP, it's been a week of real contrasting emotions in Belgium. You started the week with, you know, the celebrating even a Poles win in San Sebastian, but the last 24 hours or so, a real shadow must have fallen over Belgian cycling.
Yes, yeah, that's exactly what it is. We have a black and white cover of our newspaper today, where yesterday's newspaper was all the optimism and euphoria about Evenepoel. So the contrast is indeed huge, and it is, like you say, a very, very big tragedy what happened to Björk Lambrecht.
Lambrecht is quite an unusual Belgian rider in a way. He was a climber and you know, tipped for great things and stage races and so on. I mean, how much did you know him and know about him?
I didn't know him personally. I knew him as a cycling journalist would know him. I knew about his result, about the Ardennes Classics, where he finished fourth in the Flesh Walloon. He won the youth classification in Dauphiné this year. But he appeared on the very popular talk show Vive le Vélo, which is broadcasting during the Tour de France. He was invited there as a guest, and really everybody took a big liking to him after this show, because of the way he presented himself. He was very humble and very eager to talk with I don't know who the other guest was. I think it was Eddie Plunkaert. He listened to his stories. He had a certain naivety about him that made him very, very sympathetic and very likable.
And for the team Lotto-Soudal, you know, again, you've had a week of contrasting emotions in Belgian cycling, but for that team, a summer of contrast after their incredible Tour de France. You know, they had a real successful time there with stage wins, and Tim Wellens in the polka dot jersey as well for a while. You know, for that team, it's a real Belgian institution, isn't it? They will have been hit very hard as well by the death of such a young, rising Belgian talent.
Yes, indeed. The tour was a big success, to win three stages with Caleb Ewan, and then the stage win of Thomas de Gendt. There had been a quite harsh criticism of Lotto-Soudal before the tour, and then they kind of got the best possible result out of it. And then to contrast that with what happened to Björk Lambrecht. Right now, this must be terrible, and also they've had earlier experiences like that with Stig Brooks, which is a very beautiful and a very, very tragic story at the same time. So for a lot of people involved, like Marc Sergeant, the general manager, I think it must bring back a lot of uncomfortable memories. And yes, my thoughts and all my sympathy are really with him and with everybody with the Lotto-Soudal, within the Lotto-Soudal team.
So that was Jan-Peter de Vlieger, a journalist at Het Nieuwsblad, talking about Björk Lambrecht and the awful tragedy of his death. And he mentioned his team Lotto-Soudal, who, you know, had such an incredible Tour de France with their four stage wins there, and were on a real high after that. And to see them, the team that they had in Tour Poland, dealing with something that, you know, none of them, I mean, some of the most poignant social media posts were pictures from the breakfast table in the morning of you know, of stage three, and of Björk Lambrecht sitting there. You know, for those riders to have him as a teammate in the morning and then carry on in the race without him, I really don't know how they deal with that, and how as a team they kind of cope with this.
No, Rich, I think that's something we maybe underestimate, and it applies not only to the riders' team but also to the whole peloton, to then get back on their bikes and, well, we think finish the Tour of Poland. I think that's going to be really tough for everyone competing there. But for Lotto-Soudal, I mean, this is the latest really in a series of very difficult episodes for the team. In 2015, Chris Buchmans, one of their riders, I think it was Lotto Belisol, the team was called at the time, crashed in the Vuelta, and he was subsequently in a coma for a week after that. He made a full recovery. He's actually riding now, or he was riding last year for Vital Concept, might have retired, I think, actually, now. And, of course, there was the accident involving Stig Brooks at the 2016 Tour of Belgium. an even worse crash, and he was in a coma for 7 months, and he's still very much recovering from that. He actually came to the Tour de France this year, was in Toulouse. It was the first time he'd been to a major bike race, I think, since his crash. And that was a very poignant moment. But I remember speaking to a couple of Belgian colleagues that day, journalists, and they said that it was actually quite a difficult, it was a difficult experience for a lot of the riders. And also, I think some of the families, that a few of them had their partners there, their children there. And it was not a comfortable feeling necessarily for all of them to have a guy who had almost died, and in fact people still refer to his recovery and the fact that he didn't die as a bit of a miracle. He was almost pronounced dead after that crash, and that was quite uncomfortable, I think, for some of the riders to have him there, and when they were sort of going into battle at the Tour de France. And and now, yeah, the team has another heartbreak to overcome.
It's a real family team, in a sense. There's a real sort of family vibe about it, the way they've kept Stig Brooks as part of the family since his accident is certainly reflects well on them. And I'm sure it'll be the same here with Bjørg Lambrecht. He'll remain a part of the family. I was, you know, one of the really sad things again to read was that his parents were there in Poland with him. They'd taken a holiday, obviously, to follow him in that race. It was going to be a build up to his first Grand Tour at the Vuelta. So just heartbreaking. But that's a team, it's been a team that's been around for a long time, run by Marc Sergent, and you do get the sense that it's more than just a cycling team, that there is this kind of this family dynamic to it.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science and Sport for their long-standing support of the Cycling Podcast and of you. You can get 25% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. That's at scienceandsport.com. Now, Daniel, obviously this week's news in cycling overshadowed by the death of Bjørg Lambrecht, but we had thought we'd be talking about another young Belgian rider of huge promise, and that's Remco Evenepoel, the 19-year-old who went to San Sebastian and won in quite sensational fashion. I mean, he was dropped in the race. As he got back on, he collected bottles from the team car. They had Enric Mas, the defending champion Julien Alaphilippe, who dropped out pretty early, but Mas was obviously the rider that Evenepoel was thinking about as he collected bottles, and even, I think, as he followed Tom Squeens when the Trek Segafredo rider attacked with about 20 kilometres to go. I think he was following him just to mark that move to help Mas in the finale, but it ended up being Mas helping out Evenepoel, because on that very, very steep final climb before the drop back down into San Sebastian, that's the Murgil Tontora climb. It's a really narrow, steep road, I think up to about 22% in places. I've actually climbed up it myself, of a fashion. I mean, on a bike with low enough gears to allow me to get up it. But you drop back down, it's still quite a long way back into San Sebastian. And Evenepoel, for such a small guy, is very good time trialist as well. He dropped Squeens on the way up the climb. Squeens, of course, just out the Tour de France. Which was pretty amazing. He looked really powerful all the way up the climb, and the gap kind of just stayed the same. It was 30 to 40 seconds, and Evenepoel held it all the way back into San Sebastian. It was a pretty phenomenal performance.
Yeah, it was, Rich, and you know, 19 years of age, we've really not seen anything quite like it before, not in that standard, not in that pedigree of race, or certainly not for a long time. I mean, really precocious performances that come to mind. Thomas Lovquist, remember him? 2004 Circuit de la Sarthe, he won that a few days after his 20th birthday. Gerald Sierlec winning the German National Championships, beating Eric Zabel in 2006 as a teenager, and he subsequently went on to win the World Championships, under-23 World Championships later that year. But they were fairly good examples of flames that burned very brightly early on in their careers and then faded slightly. It's difficult to avoid or not to draw the conclusion after seeing Evenepoel at the weekend that the hype is very much justified, and this is someone who's not just going to be a good rider, but who's going to be potentially a dominant rider in cycling. But which, you know, for me, this is not, you know, if you think about emerging sort of stars and dominant figures and guys who are going to really reign supreme over cycling, I always imagined that the next one of those figures would come in a very different package, in the sense that, you know, as cycling broadens its reach across the world, that we would see someone come from a part of the world or someone who looked very different. Like, for example, a Usain Bolt in sprinting came along and he was something he didn't look like any sprinter had looked before. He was much taller, he ran in a different way. And I always thought that would be the case in cycling, or it's easy to imagine that would be the case. Evenepoel is quite an unremarkable looking guy physically. He's small, but he's not a typical climber's build. He's as you say, he looked very powerful at the weekend, but he's certainly not the doesn't have the build you'd associate with a brilliant time trialist. So it's just quite staggering, really, what he's managed to do so early. And you know, you go back a year, and people were starting to sort of murmur about this phenomenon that was in the junior ranks. He'd won pretty much every race he'd taken part in for a couple of years, almost since he started cycling, having had a very promising football career. But at that stage, a year ago, the people first started to talk about him turning pro, and skipping the under 23 ranks completely, and it seemed like a preposterous idea. And actually, Quickstep and Patrick Lefebvre were criticised for it.
And he is skipping the under 23 ranks. I mean, he's still eligible to ride in the under 23 road race. This has been a bit controversial in the past, where riders on World Tour teams have taken part in the under 23 road race and time trial. He has said he doesn't want to do that. He wants to ride the senior road race in Yorkshire this year.
And you'd have to imagine he's got a great chance.
He's going to win it.
Wow. I mean, I think of his performances so far, of everything that he's achieved, the performance that will always stick in my mind is his ride in the Junior World Championships last year in Innsbruck, where he was caught off the back and pretty much rode through the whole field and then won the race. He won't do that, obviously, in the Senior World Championships in Yorkshire, but it's already getting to a point where he's very much in contention for a leadership role in the Belgian national team, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, you would have to think so. I mean, San Sebastian is 227 kilometres. It's not a short race, not quite as long as the World's, and this year in particular, World Championships is a very, very long road race. Cyril Guimard, the legendary former director, still coach of the French national team, isn't he, said of Evenepoel at the weekend, he's not the new Merckx, but Merckx plus Eno with a taste of Bernal and Kylian Mbappe.
Kylian Mbappe has never won a bike race, though.
The French footballer. I mean, that a little bit of hyperbole there, perhaps, from Guimard. Yeah, I mean, that's ridiculous, isn't it, really? You can't say already, we don't really know what his limits are, to suggest that he, you know, is all those, the three riders plus a footballer thrown in, seems a bit fanciful.
Well, and I think as a nice counterpoint to that, the typically self-effacing Roger de Vlaeminck said something along the lines of, well, I was also good as a 19-year-old.
I think he lamented the fact that he wasn't allowed to turn professional that young, and had he done so, he would have produced similar results. Yeah, de Vlaeminck throwing a bit of cold water on the Evenepoel hype.
And obviously Evenepoel and his exploits will now be subject and scrutinised by the whole sort of Belgian cycling community. All the pundits like de Vlaeminck, who are always trotting out whenever there's a big story, cycling story in Belgium. The one slight reservation I have about Evenepoel is I don't think there's a worse place to be a precocious young cyclist than Belgium.
Maybe why he's moving to Monaco or Andorra or some other tax haven that apparently he's moving to. He does seem quite a level-headed guy. I mean, his performance at the junior road race in Innsbruck last year was beyond, you know, convincing, crushing, dominant. It was unbelievable. I mean, you know, he had been held up in a crash. He was at 2 minutes off the back, chased them, got back on, and he doesn't seem to tire. That's the thing. I mean, I think even on this climb at the weekend, this very, very steep climb, he just had bundles of energy. And it's hard to know. We're going to hear in a minute a chat with Jan-Peter de Vlieger again about Evenepoel, who he knows very well. And it's a hard job, I think, for to kind of quite set to manage him over the next few years, because at 19 you got to be thinking about him as a 25, 26 year old, 27 year old rider, not just the next couple of years. And how do you manage his progress and his own, I guess, desperation to ride some of the biggest races? It could be another 3 years before we see him in a Grand Tour, for example. But here's what Jan-Peter de Vlieger said. He's the cycling correspondent at Het Nieuwsblad, or one of many, and as I say, he knows Evenepoel well. Unfortunately, he wasn't in San Sebastian, as we hear now.
He's probably quite soon going to be the Remco Evenepoel correspondent, one of several Het Nieuwsblad now.
JP, I saw you in San Sebastian last year chasing after Greg Van Avermaet. This year, a Belgian 1-2 this year, and you weren't there.
No. We made a big mistake, and we won't ever make that mistake again. We discussed it during the Tour de France. Should we go to San Sebastian, yes or no? And because of my experience of last year, where indeed I tried to chase Greg Van Avermaet and didn't get him, we kind of decided that it wasn't worthwhile, since we don't have a Sunday's newspaper as well in Belgium, and the race is on Saturday, so there's no real urgency, so we decided not to go, which was, of course, a big mistake.
But you couldn't, I mean, Van Avermaet aside, you couldn't have expected Evenepoel, surely, to win such a big race so young.
Exactly. Well, with him, you never know, but this, to expect this would be kind of a bit ludicrous, even, I think, to suggest that he would win San Sebastian, given that he had never raced that distance, that he never done a World Tour race. So that would be, very, very something that you couldn't come up with.
What was the reaction like in Belgium to his win?
Very euphoric, of course. It's been the ultimate confirmation, I think, of his talent. Before, there's always been reservations, small reservations. When he won the Hammer Series, it was only the Hammer Series, and when he won the Baloise Belgian Tour, it wasn't a World Tour race. And now it's just a race where there are no possible reservations. What he did was so amazing, so unthinkable that everybody just, yes, finally gives in to this, the hype is real idea. And there was a big optimism about Belgium's future, and especially with Evenepoel.
The talent is obvious, but how does, he seems very kind of mature, level-headed, he speaks very well, but how does his personality come across in Belgium?
Just like you say, he seems to be very mature and wise before his years. I interviewed him after his double world title in Innsbruck, and already then it struck me, like, often when you interview these really, really young guys or young riders, there's a certain naivety when it comes to dealing with the media, but he doesn't have that at all. He's very aware of what he says, and it wouldn't surprise me if, as a football player, he had some kind of media training, because he knew how the game worked. That was very obvious, and that's very rare for an 18-year-old guy. And maybe that's a bit of a danger as well, because it takes a bit away of his authenticity. Perhaps he always plays down his victories, and that's, of course, what you're supposed to do. But it seems like he's very aware of the image that and the importance that of his words after a race. And in that way, he's mature, that this spontaneity or naivety is not really there, I think.
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, what do you do with a guy like that? The pressure will be enormous. The expectation in Belgium will be enormous, that he's the next Tom Bonin or the next Eddie Merckx. He's still only 19. You know, it could be 3 years before he rides a Grand Tour. How do you think Patrick Lefebvre and De Koenen and Quickstep will manage his career over the next few years?
That's an interesting question. They said this season that they would keeping him on a very, very small race program, but he's so talented that he kind of, because of his talent, they have to give him more races and bigger races. So he's been ahead of the schedule, I think, for his entire life. And indeed, like you say, what they think now is to do the Tour de France in 3 years for the first time. But honestly, I don't think that we will wait or it will take as long as 3 years before we see him in the Tour de France. There's a big expectation or a big question mark in Belgium right now. What can he do in the Tour? And to think that it would take 3 years before we see him there, I don't know. But perhaps it would be a wise thing to wait with this, with the biggest possible race for another 3 years. That would perhaps not be a bad idea, but there will be a lot of pressure to put him in the Tour earlier, I think.
And finally, on Evenepoel, you know, how big a figure is he already now in Belgium, in the kind of sporting landscape? How much coverage does he get, and how popular and how major a figure has he become already?
He's, I think, one of the most prolific riders or even sportsmen in Belgium at this time. My friends who are not into cycling, they only talk to me about Remco Evenepoel. What is he going to win? How good is he? It's difficult to overstate the impact he has already. Like, we had up to 5 or 6 pages in our Monday's newspaper about his win in San Sebastian. So he's really, really big. If you see the best clicked pieces on our website, if Evenepoel is in the headline, people click on it. It's really, he's very, very big at the moment.
Does he have a nickname yet?
No, but that's where you come in, no? That's where the cycling podcast is famous.
Well, we'll get to work on that. We'll set Lionel Burney on that.
L'Equipe called him Le Petit Cannibal once, and that was not.
Yeah, he is
too bad.
He is small, isn't he? He's quite diminutive.
Yeah, he is. Which makes it strange that he's such a good time trialist, because he is indeed quite small. But if I may add this, there was an interesting piece, I thought, in the Standard Belgian newspaper, where they say that the shadow of Frank van den Broeke is a bit above Evenepoel at this moment. And I think that is true, because everybody in cycling seems to be very cautious not to add too much to the hype and not to overhype him. And you could even in the commentary on the live broadcast Saturday, José de Cover, who's a very knowledgeable commentator, he was a bit reluctant to add credibility that Evenepoel would win the race. He said if any other rider would be with like 8 Ks to go, would be in this position, we would be super excited. But because it's Evenepoel, we kind of play it down a little bit. And that's the sentiment that a lot of people have, not to overhype and not to contribute to the hype, because everybody feels a little bit complicit to what happened to VDB, and nobody wants to make the same mistake again, I think.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
Seb Piquet, the voice of race radio at the Tour de France, interrupts this week's episode to remind me to tell you that it is sponsored by LACA. LACA is the community-driven bicycle insurer. It's a game-changing concept to insure your bike and gear, in which you only share the true costs of damages and thefts with other members of the LACA community. But don't take my word for it. Let's hear from a LACA customer now who had a recent experience, an unfortunate experience in which he had to make a claim.
My name is Chris O'Hearn. I've been a LACA customer since early 2018, and I do lots. I do road cycling, masters racing, track racing at Herne Hill, and commuting. My recent experience with LACA was I was on a cycling holiday in the Basque Country, having a great time, and unfortunately had a bit of a crash on the descent, and did my collarbone. LACA couldn't do anything about that, but also did a bit of damage to the bike. And got back and needed a few things done to some repairs to the bike. And LACA sorted out really quickly. It was amazing. Well, first thing I saw was my doctor. And then I went to the bike shops and got a crash report just to check that everything was okay. They said there are a few bits that needed to be fixed, including some odd damage to the chainring. Don't quite know how I did that. Put in the crash report to LACA, and within 3 hours had a call from the bike shop to say, Laka had called them and sorted out the claim and come back and get it all sorted. It was amazing. I mean, I got online, spoke to the guys at Laka immediately, sent in all the stuff that I needed to do. They processed it really quickly, and within a matter of hours, they'd sorted it out with the bike shop. The body is still recovering, I'm afraid, and can't get any spare collarbones.
So thank you to Laka for sponsoring this week's episode of the Cycling Podcast, Laka Bicycle Insurance, powered by the community. If you'd like to check out what Laka have to offer and insure your bikes and equipment, go to laka.co.uk. That's laka.co.uk to find out more about bicycle insurance powered by you. Join a community of cyclists to play fair and take good care to save each other money on insurance. Daniel, this is the first time we've met since the Tour de France, and I do want to ask you about that in a moment, but we were listening to Jan-Peter de Vlieger there talking about Remco Evenepoel, and you made an interesting point.
Well, there's a slight parallel here with someone else who's come to cycling from another sport, another discipline, and that's Primoz Roglic.
He's come to the sport from another discipline, you see?
Yeah, this is the first cycling podcast world exclusive since the Tour de France. Apparently, Primoz Roglic used to be a ski jumper. I was speaking to his manager, who's a Swiss gentleman called Mattia Galli, at the Giro, and we talked about Roglic's trajectory, the path of his career so far in cycling. And Mattia was saying to me that one of the key things in his view is that Roglic has always had this positive momentum because he's moved through the different steps and he's moved up the ladder very quickly and smoothly. He's always had positive experiences. He pretty much won the first races he did, and then he had success straight away when he turned professional, and this has kind of created a sort of feel-good factor, an internal kind of positive momentum, which has probably fueled and helped his success thus far. And the difficulty will come, as it maybe did for Roglic this year, when for the first time he ceased to exceed expectations, and I think the same will probably happen with Evenepoel at some point. It's easier to succeed at something when you're coming off a lot of success. The motivation tends to flow a lot more easily.
It's also, you're mentioning that the unusual nature of his emergence from a country like Belgium, where he is clearly an outlier. He's from a country with this great cycling tradition and culture, and yet, unusually perhaps for a Belgian cyclist, he's come to the sport quite late.
Yeah, I mean, 4 years ago he was still playing football for Belgium under-16s, Anderlecht under-16s.
Just a little bit of business before we carry on and look back a bit on the Tour de France. We've got a couple of friends specials. One has just been released, the Giro Rosa Diaries, with Lizzie Banks and Taylor Wiles. A really great listen, available to friends of the podcast. And coming up, Lunch with Jonathan Vauters. Lionel went for lunch with Jonathan Vauters, as the title suggests, during the Tour de France. And that's a really interesting listen as well. They touch on some of the things covered in Vauters' recently published autobiography, but it's a really good listen. That'll be coming out for friends of the podcast very, very soon. Another couple of episodes coming out this week. The latest cycling podcast, Femina, is out on Thursday this week. Lots packed into that, of course, from La Course, the Giro Rosa, some of the other recent races. And on Friday, the second episode of Service Course, our monthly show that focuses on tech and equipment and so on, presented by Tom Wally and Kieran McVitie. That's coming out on Friday. Now, we've also got our tour coming out later in the year. First of all, an event in Harrogate at the World Championships on Friday the 27th of September at the Royal Hall in Harrogate. Biggest event we'll ever have done. You can get tickets at thecyclingpodcast.com. If you click on live events down the side, it'll take you to our live events page, and the Harrogate event is there, as are events in our Grand Tour, which is kicking off in Bristol at the Bristol St George's Hall on Monday 11th of November, then Cardiff St David's Hall Tuesday the 12th, Worcester Huntingdon Hall on the 13th, that's a Wednesday. Belfast Mac MAC on Friday the 15th November. That's our best selling event so far, almost sold out in Belfast, so do go to the website for tickets for that soon. Then we'll be doing events at the Arts Theatre in London on the 18th and the 25th of November, the Leicester Y Theatre on the 28th of November, and Manchester RNCM on Saturday the 30th of November. Still a few more dates and venues to be announced, but you can go to thecyclingpodcast.com and get tickets for those live events. You click on live events down the side. Finally, before we go back to the Tour de France, we are on the lookout for good causes for the Vuelta. We'll be selling more of Stacey Snyder's beautiful handmade mugs. They sold out at the Giro, and they sold out even quicker at the Tour de France, so they raised lots of money for good causes. And that money has been handed over to the West Lothian Cycle Park and the David Carey Scholarship Fund. Thank you very much indeed to all your support for those. And send us your nominations for good causes for the Vuelta, please. Email is best, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. Now, Daniel, yes. We didn't see a lot of you at the Tour de France because you were all self-important with a camera crew following you around everywhere you went, you know. You always had your team.
My sirens are always wailing at the tour, aren't they? I'm like a fireman going out.
You're like Kim Kardashian at the tour.
What? Babe, what's that based on?
Somebody very famous.
Qualify that, all right.
I imagine she has a camera crew following her around all the time. Yeah. Anyway, you at the end of the tour, you gave it four, your famous wine glass rating. You gave it four. Still, 2003 stands out as the only five-star tour of all the tours that you've covered. I was surprised to see that. I guess if you had a 4.5-star rating, it might have got that. If you had a 7-star rating, 7 wine glass rating, as we adopted, stealing Magnus Cort's hotel rating system, then it might have been, you know, out on its own somewhere, nudging towards the maximum score. But it can't have been too far off.
Well, with a week to go, I was convinced that it was going to get 5 stars, but the Alps were a big disappointment because of the imponderables, the weather. There was an element of that. I mean, I spoke to Christian Prudhomme a couple of days from the end, and he made a convincing case, or a strong case, for the inherent drama of the landslides and on the Stade Tatin, that adding to the magic of this Tour de France. But I think that added to what came next, the shortened stage the next day, which wasn't a fantastic spectacle either. I thought that it was a bit of an anticlimax. It was a bit of a muted note on which to end what had been a fantastic tour.
Yeah, Prudhomme spinning things a little bit there, isn't he? You can't polish a landslide, can you? You can't polish a mudslide. I mean, it was obviously disturbing for the race, and I think just the weather in the Alps was disturbing for a lot of other reasons as well. I mean, the fact that the Tour de France has never had that in all its history. It was, I said before, but I was in the car just ahead of the race, and the way that the weather transformed from being very nice and sunny and clear blue skies into this kind of grey hellscape, it was amazing, with solid ice beneath us, cars skidding off the road, cars stopping. It was almost unbelievable.
You compare me to Kim Kardashian. I heard that you did that stage in a helicopter. I heard that you did the tour now in a helicopter.
Well, occasionally it's just a bit easier, Daniel, to get from A to B in a helicopter. I'm not. That's not become a habit. It was very much a one-off, that I can assure you. The other thing that you were talking about before we started recording was the Thibaut Pinot documentary that was released on the final weekend of the tour, and that really caught a lot of people's attention, not just cycling fans, but in France in particular. I think it had a huge impact.
Well, in a Tour de France of many fantastic, captivating storylines, Rich. I think my favourite was the whole Thibaut Pinot story, and it was captured brilliantly by a France Télévisions documentary, which was aired on the final Sunday, I think, called Avec Thibaut. It was supposed to be a half-hour documentary, but they had so much good footage, and the story was so captivating that I think they ran it to 45 minutes in the end. And everyone pretty much knows the story, knows how Thibaut Pinot's tour went. There were some fantastic highs. I think the Stade de Saint-Étienne, the last half hour of the Stade de Saint-Étienne, was one of probably the best half hour I can remember in the Tour de France since I've been covering it for the last 18 years, with Alaphilippe and Pinot off the front on a stage where you wouldn't really have expected too much to go on as far as the general classification classification was concerned. And then from the sort of triumph of that day to the despair a couple of days later of the stage where Pino lost time in crosswinds to Albi. And one of the really fantastic segments of the Avec Thibault documentary was the sort of debrief, the post-mortem after that, and very, very raw footage of Pino getting on the bus and really tearing strips off his teammate Anthony Roux and sort of muttering to himself about how useless they all were and how useless Anthony Roux had been when William Bonnet and Stefan Kung had kept him safe for 200 kilometres between them, and then Anthony Roux had not managed to do it for even 20 kilometres. And, you know, I just thought it was a fantastically raw antidote to some of the slightly more contrived sports documentaries that we're seeing now, which, you know, have value. There's a lot of stuff being put out now on Netflix and Amazon Prime, a lot of it focusing on American sports, some of it very, very good, but you always sense a bit airbrushed, a bit diluted, whereas this, you know, I believe it was very raw. And I know some of the people who worked on the documentary, Nicolas Jay, the reporter for France Television, was very very much involved in it, and I talked to him this week actually about how it had all come together, why Pino had decided to let a camera crew film pretty much everything at the tour. And apparently, Pino, as most people know, is a huge football fan. And last year there was a fly-on-the-wall documentary from the World Cup of the French national team, filmed by some of the same people. And Pino had loved it so much that he had suggested they do something similar for this year's Tour de France. So the initiative apparently had all come from him. It was a bit of a surprise to me and a lot of other people, including Nicolas, because Pino is always someone who he's always been someone who's kind of shunned the limelight, doesn't like social media particularly, is quite a private person, quite a sort of discreet individual. But for some reason he thought that this was going to be something that was worth doing, and it very much was.
But something that people always say about Pino is that he's a very authentic character, and it strikes me that this was a very authentic portrayal of his struggles, his successes and his struggles at the Tour de France. And I guess that's what he signed up to, something that would authentically show people. And it seems to have done that. And I think, there are people, I know my wife is French and isn't really into cycling and wouldn't have been able to pick Thibaut Pino out of a lineup of, you know, people. She watched it and was absolutely captivated by it, and captivated by Pino himself. And I think what it will have done, you know, when we talk about, I don't know if we talk about a crisis in French cycling, but maybe a lack of heroes, a lack of really identifiable stars, I think it will have taken Pino to a whole new audience, and the sport as well on the back of Pino.
Well, certainly, Rich, in an era and in an age when people suspect that a lot of the way sport is presented is quite cynical and quite contrived and quite synthetic, and, you know, we do get a lot of athletes portraying a certain image of themselves on social media, and people are starting to get a little bit weary of some aspects of that. I think Pino's authenticity does come through, and did come through really strongly. And, you know, it did. I think the documentary, a lot of people focused on the very emotional scene with Marc Madiot, which was also a fantastic watch, and people were a little bit cynical about it. They suggested that Madiot was hamming it up for the cameras. If you know Marc Madiot, I think he has a similar, or there are similarities in his view of the media and his approach to the media to the way Thibaut Pino feels about the media. He's not particularly interested. He is someone who, I think, if he was to do a list of the values that he holds most dear and thinks the most important, authenticity would be at the top of that list. And I think Madiot was authentic in that documentary. So I think on an emotional level, the scenes with him and Pino really will connect with people, or did connect with people. But also just on a very granular level, I think sometimes people, we're all a bit naive about the tiny details that go into winning a race or success, or that dictate success or failure in a race like the Tour de France. And the stage, the scenes on the stage in Albi in the crosswinds really brought that into focus, how what had been a tiny mistake, so and it all happened on this, what became this magic, this infamous roundabout, that had cost Pino almost 2 minutes, and that ultimately could have been the difference between him winning and losing the Tour. And it all came down to basically whose fault was it? Was it the fault of the Directs Sportifs, who, yes, had given the riders maps and had briefed them on that particular part of the course, but they hadn't gone into enough detail on that roundabout? Was it the fault of the individual who most teams now have, someone who goes ahead of the race on the day of the race and feeds back information, so would have seen the way the roundabout was set up? Was it their fault? Was it the Pino's teammate's fault? Anthony Roux, you know, I mentioned. And you know, often we do look at races and sporting events with broad brush strokes, we say, and we resort to cliches. Pino is not good in the third week, Pino is too fallible in this respect or that respect, but it really comes down to these tiny sort of pixels in the huge picture that makes up the Tour de France.
And I think that's why this is a tour, whether it's five wine glasses or not, it's a tour we will return to. And backtracking a bit on what I said about Prudhomme, he's right in a sense that I think that stage 19 in particular will be dissected and looked at, and you know, the what ifs from that stage are numerous. The drama of the weather, the decision to stop the race at the top of Isère, how that decision was made, who made it. These are things that will return to. The crosswind stage is another one. There are all these things that went on that will, you're almost crying out for us to go back and revisit already and discuss. And I think that's what will make this tour one for the ages, in a sense. It, you know, its afterlife will be long and very, very interesting. And, you know, what's going to happen with Egan Bernal in the future as well?
Yeah, and my slight fear as far as the French are concerned is this could unfortunately be the high watermark in terms of, you know, drama, emotion, hope, expectation for the next, an opportunity for the next few years, because it's almost quite difficult to imagine, well, certainly Pino and Alaphilippe being in contention to win the Tour again in the near future. When you look at Bernal, you imagine Bernal's going to be stronger next year. Chris Froome might be back. He might be as strong as he has been in the past. Thomas will be there again. Dumoulin might be back, and he'll be, you would imagine, strong again. So you would think that after the success from a French point of view of this year, Thierry Gouvenou and Christian Prudhomme, the two guys who are essentially responsible for designing the Tour route, will come up with something similar. But does lightning strike twice in the same way that it struck this year? I'm not so sure.
They'll be just waiting for David Gaudu, I guess, the French. Daniel, what about, finally before we go, you mentioned Tom Dumoulin, the rumours of his move to Jumbo-Visma. What do you know about that? Sunweb seem determined to keep him. They've got him under contract, but there seems to be quite a lot of pressure coming from Jumbo-Visma, who seem to suddenly have quite a bit of money swilling around.
I heard during the Tour de France it was a done deal pretty much, but done in the sense that it was decided that he was going to leave and he was going to go to Jumbo-Visma, but the details were not sorted, and I don't think they have been sorted yet. I think that's what will happen. He will be riding for them next year, but that raises other questions. They will then have three Grand Tour leaders in Roglic, Kreiswijk and Dumoulin, who I don't imagine will be willing to share out the three Grand Tours and each lead one of them. I think they've probably all got an eye on the Tour de France next year.
Well, before we go, this week I mentioned the Friends Specials episodes coming up. We'll also have a Tour de France road trip available at some point. That's so vast that it's going to take weeks to hammer into shape. But the Giro Rosa Diary is definitely worth a listen, and Lionel's Lunch with Jonathan Vauter is similarly a really good listen. Our thanks to a few of you who've signed up as friends of the podcast recently. Neil Huff, Graham Tuff, don't know if they're all going to rhyme these names, Fiona Devlin, Irene Hjorth, Robert Robertson, Adrian Murray, Paul Mortel, Alistair Campbell, I don't think that's the Alistair Campbell, might be, Ben Bartlett, Paul Molyneux, Matthew Bushby, and Oliver Coot.
Lexi Brown, Elizabeth Levitt, Richard Worley, Andrew Morris, Cesar Jaramillo, Andrew Gifford, Mark Blatchford.
Thank you very much to you all, and we're very grateful to you for your support. Thank you very much, Daniel. See you next week.
Thank you, Rich.
You've been listening to the Cycling Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us and leave a review on Facebook and iTunes. Just search online for The Cycling Podcast. This episode was edited and produced by Adam Bowie.